So we are having an extra meeting because it's now a deadline. And thank you, everyone, for coming in for this additional meeting. We do have quite a bit of work to do. First order of business, of course, is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Present.
So my question.
Backer. I'm Backer, present.
Bonner.
Hold on one moment.
Bonner, present. Bierman.
Bierman, present.
Bolden.
Bolden, present.
Demuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz. Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Wolgamott, present. A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from March 30th. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move approval of the minutes from the March 30th committee hearing.
Thank you. The minutes have been moved. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes from March 30th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So the first bill on our agenda today, and we've got a lot of business. I want to keep people here only as long as necessary. So we're going to move somewhat rapidly, but we have Representative Herr with House File 3470. We have heard this bill, and so we're not going to do a rehearing, but the intention today is to move it to the general register. So the chair will move that House File 3470 be re-referred to the general register. And Representative Herr, if you would just remind the committee of what we have before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and appreciate the time to just discuss briefly House File 3470. As a reminder, this bill provides a bed moratorium exception for Children's Minnesota to open a new 22-bed inpatient mental health unit at its St. Paul Hospital. We had a good discussion on this bill in February and received letters of support from Hennepin Healthcare, Prairie Care, Aspire Minnesota, Mental Health Minnesota, and NAMI Minnesota. Children's continues to work with MDH on the public interest review application. And just as a reminder that because the plan for the new unit came together quickly in response to the mental health crisis among our kids, Children's submitted its PIR application after the August statutory deadline. And so with this clear need, we hope that you will continue, that this will pass and we'll get the support of the members here. And we do ask for your support. I do have Dr. Chawla available in case anybody has further questions. But with that, I will wrap up my comments.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Herr. Is there any discussion or questions from members? All right. Not seeing any. So I will renew my motion that House File 3470 be re-referred to the general register. And Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Eklund.
Eklund, aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Demuth.
Aye.
Demuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grinhagen.
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Breyer, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
19 ayes and 0 nays. The bill is passed and on its way to the General Register. Congratulations, Representative Herr. And we'll also note for the record that Representative Schultz is present. I think she was in another committee when the roll was called, which reminds me, too, to note for the record that this is a busy time of year and members shouldn't be concerned if that happens to them. We will note your presence when you're here. So thank you very much, Representative Herr. And we will move on now. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3403. And this is Representative Stevenson's bill, and I think has not been able to join us quite yet. So that being the case, I'm going to move on to House File 4704, which is my bill. And members, as we posted, this is here merely as a vehicle bill. This is actually leftover language from last session. And so the contents of the bill, as members know, is kind of immaterial. What we're doing today is moving this one to Ways and Means just to park a vehicle there. This is not our main, this is not the vehicle for our main omnibus bill. This is just a backup. I just want to be clear about that. So there will be another one coming that we will be using for our DE that will be our omnibus bill for the session. So with that, any questions, members, or comments? Okay, so we just need to move this one out. So my motion is that House File 4704 be re-referred to Ways and Means. So Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Greenhagen.
Aye.
Greenhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
All right. Thank you very much, members. So there being 19 ayes and 0 nays, House File 4704 is re-referred to Ways and Means. Is Representative Stevenson here yet? Okay, I'm not seeing him.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McQuillan.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Chair Stevenson actually just arrived.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Okay. Chair Stevenson, when you get yourself settled, we're just about to take up your bill if you are ready.
I am ready, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late.
No worries. We know what's going on here. I've already stated we know members are in different committees and trying to multitask. So so the chair will move House File 3403, the first engrossment, be re-referred to Ways and Means. That gets the bill before the committee. And there is an author's amendment, Representative Stevenson, the A3, and I think it's kind of a technical amendment. Am I right? Should we adopt that now?
It is a technical amendment. I would appreciate it if the committee would adopt it.
All right. So I would move then the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion to the A3 author's amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A3, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So with that, to Representative Stevenson, to House File 3403 as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill is a, fairly common sense bill that allows people who are seeking, who are interested in pursuing a career which requires a license, to get a determination from the licensing authority as to whether they are eligible to receive that license before they invest the time and energy necessary to get the education and training or work experience that's necessary to obtain the license. So what we're concerned about here is if there's someone who perhaps has a criminal conviction that disqualifies them from getting a certain license, we'd like them to know up front that they can't get that license before they expend their time, energy, and resources trying to get that license. I want to be very clear that this bill does not change the requirements for any license under our state law. So if a criminal conviction disqualifies you from holding a job under current law, this bill changes nothing. You would still be disqualified. It just allows you to figure out on the front end whether you are or are not eligible to get a license based on your criminal record. I think it's an important way to save people a lot of time and money and help people who have criminal histories get reintegrated in society. As a prosecutor, I can tell you that if someone's able to get a career and get reintegrated, that they're much less likely to commit crime in the future, and that's important. At the same time, we have these disqualifications for very good reasons, and so no one's saying that we should change that, at least not in this bill. We're just trying to make sure people understand on the front end where they sit. And Madam Chair, I do believe there's some testifiers here to speak to the bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson. And we have Anna Odegaard. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We are a statewide coalition of 135 nonprofit organizations working to reduce barriers to economic mobility. We have been working in partnership with the Justice Action Network, the Institute for Justice, and the Council of State Governments Justice Centers to advance this legislation that creates better transparency in our licensing process. I hope you will take a look at their written testimony, which I believe is included in your packets. We are very grateful to Representative Stevenson for taking the lead on this legislation, and of course to Chair Liebling for hearing the bill. The Minnesota Asset Building Coalition considers the transparency in licensing bill a top priority because many of our members offer workforce development services, including for individuals working on reintegrating back into their communities after incarceration. Lack of transparency in the licensing process is a barrier to work for many of their clients. For instance, my colleague Ken Sariakoff from Goodwill Easter Seals, which is an MABC member, explained to me that because there's no formal process for people to find out if their criminal history will affect their eligibility for a license, instead, people rely on rumor. So someone hears from someone with a similar conviction that they were denied a different license. And what Ken says is that a lot of his clients are reluctant to even try to qualify down a vocational path that might lead to a family-sustaining job because they can't afford to make that investment in the education and the training and the licensure exam without knowing if there's actually a possibility of licensure at the end of the road. This may seem like a problem affecting only a small number of people, but roughly 30% of Americans have a criminal history, and about 22% of jobs in Minnesota require some kind of license or registration that can be denied based on a criminal history. A straightforward process for people who have a criminal history to find out how their record impacts their eligibility for occupational licensure benefits businesses that need qualified licensed employees. It supports stability for those individuals and their families and ultimately benefits our communities. Thank you so much for considering this bill and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Odegaard. So I don't think I have any other testifiers on the list, but I think we could go to member questions and comments. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it seems to me that the main pro on doing this is so that people would understand and not go through a lengthy and delaying, et cetera. So why wasn't the common sense idea of requiring that anything that is disqualifying be listed on a list that would be in the same location as, you know, the website where you would apply or in with the forms that you would apply with? And that way you're not producing a bunch of overhead and you're getting the information out there and it can be clear and concise and to the point. And we aren't in this bill, it opens up the possibility of there was an oops in this quick preliminary. And when we went through the full process, we would be denying, except for you're not available to deny if you've given a preliminary okay. So I think this bill's intent could be easily covered in a less costly fashion and a little bit easier to understand. And that way they don't go through a two-step process, which I think would be more delays than just going ahead and up front telling them this is a list of things that are disqualifying. So would the author be able to tell me why that approach wasn't taken?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Quam. Well, there's a few things there that I just want to clear up. One is there's nothing, this isn't like a quick preliminary look. The idea would be to do the full check of criminal records on the front end. So there's not like we're going to take a half measure on the when we're doing this. We're going to actually look and see if someone is eligible. The second thing is that your idea, I understand the common sense nature of it, but it doesn't work because oftentimes it's not so simple as having a list. And I can speak from experience as a prosecutor, especially when you're talking about convictions in other states, often have very different offense names. They don't match up exactly. You have to look and see, is this what kind of penalty, what kind of offense, what did the statute say? It is not as simple as just having a list. And it really will also depend on the license in terms of what is prohibited. So that approach is not so simple. I also want to push back very heavily on the idea that this is burdensome, cumbersome, or costly. The fiscal note, there's a lot of agencies involved, and so they're still assembling, but I talked to some agencies and seen some preliminary estimates, and in almost all cases, it's negligible cost because this is something they would have to do for these licensees anyway, and they're just doing it on the front end before the person gets the training. So I hope that clears up the misconceptions there, but this really is actually the common sense approach, which is like, let's figure out before you go through it whether or not you can actually get the license.
Okay, Representative Quam, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is that the preliminary isn't a quick and easy one. It's basically doing what the regular qualification check is. So why are you then duplicating it? And the thing is that each of the applications would be, you know, from the area and would have its own list. I mean, so you take away the, well, every area has a different, well, every list would be specific to the area where you go to apply. So again, I don't see that this is a intelligent way to make it better when a much more straightforward thing could be done. So we'll have discussions on the floor, I assume.
Okay, let's move on to Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Stevenson, I would have very similar concerns based on the input I've had that Representative Quam stated. And I don't know if you can get clarification on that. I know on the surface it doesn't seem like it's such, you know, you're just trying to help out, but we're getting this input that once they give preliminary approval, they can't change their mind. I don't know if you think that holds water or not, but it'd be nice just to have it clarified a little bit more, and because that's the type of input we're getting right now. So you can respond if you want to. Thank you.
Chair Stevenson, did you want to?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen. You know, I understand why this idea, I can understand where the concern comes from, but I hope that I would like to try to address it, because you get, what happens here is you get someone's criminal record, you know, and someone's going to look it over and look at those offenses from Minnesota and other states, and they're going to make a determination about whether they can get a license. And we say that's binding unless there's a mistake or someone gets a new conviction or so on. But the information, it's the same information that the person will be looking at before and after. So it makes sense for it to be binding. It gives the person who's going through the process the understanding that they really can go through it. Just like if they had gone through everything and the licensee and the licensing agency had looked through the information and made a decision, that would be binding too. It's the same information, it's the same process. We're just doing it earlier. So I just struggle with the concern that there's going to be all these mistakes, because it's, we're doing the same thing, we're just doing it at a different point in time. And we're doing that so that people don't waste their time and energy and money on things. And I will just say that I think that that's why this bill has bipartisan support. It's had bipartisan support, I think, in every committee in the House it's gone through. It has, it's in Senate Finance now. It's moved through three Senate committees, presumably on bipartisan votes there. I have Republican authorship here in the House and in the Senate. This is not an effort to relax or reduce or do anything. It's just an effort to give people a chance to figure out if they're eligible for a career before they go through with it.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And real quickly, as many of you know, that I love working on vocational licensing, and the cumbersome efforts of getting a license in Minnesota is touches many, many vocations, including EMS, funeral directing, real estate. And what's really frustrating is somebody that made a terrible error, a stupid error when they were 18, and they're looking for to move on and maybe get some training, basically is don't know until after they finish the program. Their name goes into the state, and all of a sudden it gets bumped back. This happens quite a few times, and so I really appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Stevenson. I think this is going to help us from people like IE funeral directors. We're one of the few states that has a four-year degree program. You won't know if you're eligible for that until you actually get done with the four-year program, invest all that money, and then get bumped. So, you know, and I've had great conversations with the Institute of Justice on this too. And so, you know, and these aren't people wondering if, you know, of a sexual offense or something like that. These are people that maybe were involved in a underage drinking or something like that, that they just don't know if they're going to be bumped or not. So I really appreciate this, and this will help us with our workforce shortage too. Thank you.
All right. I have Representative Backer, then Representative Ackland. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I would agree with Representative Hewitt there in regards with, we all have made mistakes in the past. The only concern that I have that I would share with the agency is sometimes these extra vetting process, which intentionally is meant to help things, will seems to slow things down. You know, especially in West Central Minnesota, when there's someone who wants to become a EMT or a nurse or LPN or any of those, we know how much challenges we have in the medical field, that we really want to make sure that this process goes quickly and is accurate, because we don't want people who apply and there's a mistake and so forth. So, but at the end of the day, I do understand we don't want a person to invest 2-3 years of training, apply, and then they find there's a hiccup on their record. This way they can get it taken care of. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Very briefly, I really appreciate Representative Backer's comment. And the only thing I wanted to add to hopefully address one piece of his concern is that this process is optional for the applicant. You would not have to get pre-qualified. You could go through and do your normal thing and then apply the normal way. So hopefully it wouldn't slow anyone down.
All right, thank you. Representative Ackland and then Damuth. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question for Representative Stevenson. So I have a question and a question. So is when you're licensing someone, these boards, is the background check really the most time-consuming, expensive part of the process? And I ask that question because it seems like in the bill, the fee for doing this preliminary application can be up to the charge of the fee for the licensure. So that seems extreme to charge that full fee, to be able to charge the full fee when we're only doing the background check. And then my second part is, if the background check, if they are disqualified, is the money returned or part of the money, or how does that work?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Ackland. You know, it's interesting, the history behind that provision. In the original draft of the bill, it just said that we could charge a fee, and it was actually Republican input in the first committee I went through. I'm trying to remember which Republican members raised the issue. They said, you know, should there be a fee for this, you know, or they should just do it, you're going to have to pay the fee later. And so what we came up with for a compromise was, you can charge a fee, but whatever you charge for the fee gets deducted from your eventual license application fee, right? So there's a $100 fee to get the license. If they charge $50 to do this, then you only have to pay another $50 when you go to apply for the actual license. And so the reason for the language that you're pointing to is because of that kind of credit. Obviously, the maximum amount that they could charge for the preliminary piece is the amount of the total license, in which case, if they did that, if they chose to do that, the total license, there would be no additional fee. Because I think you're right that it's unlikely that it would cost the whole amount to do just this piece. But that's why it says up to the amount. There's another provision in the bill that then says whatever you pay in your first license gets deducted from what you pay for your eventual license. The second answer to your question is, unfortunately, no, you don't get the money back if you're not eligible.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author, Representative Stevenson. One question, do you know if other states are doing this? And if so, maybe how many, or have there been any concerns that have come out of those states?
Representative Stevenson.
I am going to have to punt that question to Ms. Odegaard. I honestly, you stumped me. I don't know if other states are doing this.
Ms. Odegaard, do you know?
Madam Chair, yes, thank you. And Representative Damuth, thank you for that question. Megan Forbes with the Institute of Justice has been working on this legislation in many states across the country, and I'm going to try to remember her statistic. I believe it's in the Institute for Justice letter that is in your packet, but from hearing her testify, I know I've heard her say that 19 other states have this pre-application process, as well as Washington, D.C. So, and some of them have had it for many years, and I do know also from talking to some of the agency staff as they were trying to put together their fiscal estimate, they were looking to those other states to get a sense of how many people, relative to the number that ultimately apply for the license, are doing the pre-application process. And so they are, I think, using the wisdom of other states that have already implemented it to make sure that they can do it smoothly here.
Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I've got a couple of my questions myself, if there aren't any more from members. And first of all, I really appreciate this bill. And just for members' edification, obviously the reason it's in our committee is because we oversee the health licensing boards, and this applies to them in addition to other boards. And I just want to have for the record, I know, Chair Stevenson, you've worked with those boards, and you have not had any there. Let me put this another way. The boards are on board. Is that fair to say?
To my knowledge, Madam Chair, you know, there's a lot. I'm saying to my knowledge only because there's so many licensing agencies in the state. You know, that's why the fiscal note has taken a long time to come together. But to my knowledge, I have not received any objection from any board licensing
right.
in the state.
Thank you. And neither have I. Neither have I from the ones that, you know, might reach out to me about it. And my other question is just, how will folks know that this is available? Is this something, it kind of goes back a little bit to Representative Quam's question. I mean, I think he's not wrong about the idea that there should be information when you go to look up, you know, could I become a respiratory therapist? It should say something that might give you a clue that you should maybe look into it. Is how is that all going to happen?
You know, this is another one I'm going to suggest that Ms. Odegaard answer, just because she's talked to me in the past about some of the education and outreach efforts that they've talked about doing with this, and I think she'll answer it better than I can.
Ms. Odegaard?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. You know, there's not a requirement in the bill that the agencies themselves publicize this, you know, new opportunity. But what I know from, you know, as I mentioned, I have 135 nonprofit member organizations across the state, many of whom do workforce development. I will, of course, be in touch with them. They will be aware if this becomes available. And just like the rumors might stop some people from applying now, I think that that word of mouth and organizations that know it's available will make sure that those populations are aware of this opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And just maybe a suggestion for the future that perhaps, you know, if the boards are listening, or for a future iteration, maybe we should formalize a bit that some way that at least when people go to look that it's there to at least, you know, flag for them that they have a way to do this. But anyway, a final question from Representative Ackland, and then we'll take the vote on the bill. Representative Ackland.
I'm sorry to have to jump back in, but thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Stevenson, just that one last concern in my mind is that there's no options if somebody is turned down, that there's no recourse for them. And that, I don't know, you are a lawyer. It seems like to me there's always at least one opportunity, I mean, to make an explanation or do something. So just your thoughts on why there is no recourse for somebody who might be turned down, because there might be a reason. There might have been a mistake or something. So that's my question. Thank
Representative
you.
Stevenson.
You know, Madam Chair and Representative Acton, I think that that's a good concern. And it's another one that has not been, despite the fact that I've been through like three or four committees with this bill, it hasn't been raised yet. So my initial reaction is that I suppose if someone I'm looking at the bill now, and it's binding if they find that you're eligible in the preliminary piece. I don't see that it's the way that it's written. It doesn't seem to be binding in the other direction. So I suppose you could go through the normal licensing application, even if you were found in the preliminary piece to be ineligible. And then I imagine, although I would have to go look at the licensing statutes, that there's kind of recourse in those statutes specifically, if you as you're applying for it, and you would have those opportunities. But you know, I will give you my commitment that I'm going to talk to Ms. Odegaard and others after we get out of this committee about whether it makes sense to try and tweak this bill to address that concern. Because I think you're right. So you have my commitment as we continue to work on this bill. It is a bill that has a finance component, so it will need to rest in an omnibus bill. So there's another opportunity to shape it, and I will work on that and be happy to work with you on that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackland. Thank you for that answer, Representative Stevenson. I would just suggest be careful how you tweak it so you don't send the bill to judiciary. I think my understanding is the bill is not changing whatever processes there are now to appeal. So it could be lined up with Representative Ackland's concern. Maybe we need more of that. I don't know, but I don't think that's the bill before us. So, but thank you very much for your presentation. So with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3403 for the first engrossment, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Niedenhofer, if you would take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Damuth, no.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg, aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 11 ayes and 8 nays.
All right. There being 11 ayes and 8 nays, House File 3403, the first engrossment as amended, is re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson and the testifier. Okay. We are going to next take up House File 4430, Representative Schultz's bill, and Representative Schultz would be moving that House File 4430 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill, and she has an author's amendment. Representative Schultz, did you want to move that now?
What's the number on the amendment?
That is the A1 amendment, and I believe it's mainly technical when I looked at it. But A1.
Hold on, I'm pulling it up right now. Hold on, please.
So this is the one, it has its, it adds the appropriation clause.
Yep, I'm looking at it right now.
Yep.
I would like to move that amendment, please.
All right. So Representative Schultz is moving the A1 author's amendment, which is mainly technical, it looks like, but also adds an appropriation clause. Correct?
Correct.
All right. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. So Representative Schultz, please go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. This bill has been through several committee stops, and what it is, it's called the Health Affordability Bill. So we create a Health Affordability Board. And what that board does is it reviews the growth in healthcare costs over time among our providers in the state of Minnesota. It also creates a health advisory council, which advises the health board on the growth of healthcare costs over time. And this model legislation has been implemented in 9 states, both red and blue states, and it's created to try to address the high growth rate in healthcare costs. For example, in Massachusetts, they've implemented this since 2012, and over 5 years, they realized savings of $9.3 billion. And what it does, it allows the board to set benchmarking targets that if a provider's benchmark target, for example, if it's 10% growth rate, if it's above that target, they will be asked to submit a improvement plan, a program improvement plan to try to address the reasons why their healthcare costs have grown so much and ways to solve that problem to reduce that growth rate. And these are what's called program improvement plans. And there's a citation if they don't report currently in the legislation. This bill also creates a patient protection office to address issues that patients have with providers and health plans. And this is model legislation, as I said, that the Milbank Memorial Fund is working on with states. And I've been fortunate to be a fellow of Milbank Memorial Fund, along with fellows and legislators across the country, to work on healthcare reform legislation. And so this is just one piece in the package of many bills we've introduced this session to really get at healthcare cost growth. And it's very encouraging to see other states being very successful with this. I would like Minnesota to join those other states to address our high costs of healthcare and make healthcare more affordable for people across the state. So members, I'm open for questions about the bill.
and am eager to get this across the finish line and have bipartisan support.
Right. Thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Chair Schultz, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a very innovative way to address the rising cost of healthcare. I'm curious if it will apply to both non- and for-profit entities.
Representative Schultz?
It will apply. The actual definition of the entity will be defined by the board once it's created. But in the legislation, for instance, it's all provider groups that are of sufficient size. And then the board will further delineate what entities will be reviewed for their cost growth. But the smaller, very small provider groups would not be included.
Representative Morrison, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Okay. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author, Representative Schultz. How many FTEs will be in the Office of Patient Protection? How many FTEs would this bill create?
That's a good question. Thank you, Chair Liebling. That is a very good question, Representative Muth. I would have to get back to you on that because we're still waiting for the fiscal note.
Yeah. Representative Damuth, anything further on that?
I do have another question, if I may, Madam Chair.
Please. Yep.
Thank you. And then it says that the board will assess $500,000 civil penalties on healthcare entities that don't comply with the performance improvement plan. How is that going to keep all our healthcare costs lower?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. That is only if they don't submit a plan. So I think it's very easy to avoid that civil penalty. And I am in discussions and willing to discuss what that civil penalty should be, but I think it is important to have an incentive for them to complete a program improvement plan.
Okay, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a question is, Representative Schultz, did you say $9 billion was saved in Massachusetts?
Representative Schultz?
I did say that.
That's a significant savings. I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question you mentioned other states. Is Maryland one of those states?
Representative Schultz?
I believe Maryland is not one of those states, but Nevada, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington.
Okay.
All right, and Representative Bierman.
One last question. The board itself, do you know what the makeup of that would be as far as would there be legislative members on that board at all?
Representative Schultz.
Currently, as worded, no. We are looking for expertise in health finance and health economics, healthcare industry expertise. We really want a really strong group of individuals to evaluate our healthcare costs and really get to the core issue of what are the drivers and how can we address those drivers of costs and reduce the costs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so,
Representative Bierman.
That would eliminate people like me, but it would qualify people like you, Representative Schultz.
I don't know if there's a question there.
No question.
I might not be as qualified for that, but I'm qualified to understand what the reports that will be generated from this board, and so we can hopefully, as legislators, evaluate the recommendations and work with the recommendations for the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right, we're getting a little facetious here. I like that answer too. No legislators, only experts. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Schultz, do you know how they measure that savings of $9 billion? I mean, we're creating more bureaucracy here, and I know bureaucracy is a big problem with the cost of healthcare, but how did they come up with the $9 billion savings?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Grunhagen, I will send you the full report so you can read it. I don't think we have time today for me to go through how they measured that, that that is being reported by the Milbank Memorial Fund, a very highly regarded, nonpartisan foundation and fund that does healthcare research and explicitly works with states. So I think that's a real number, and it was over 5 years.
Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that response, Representative Schultz. Yeah, I actually think a different approach would be better, which would be my reference-based pricing bill, which eliminates much of the bureaucracy and puts the patient in charge of their health care. But that's just my opinion. I'll look forward to that report. Thank you.
All right. And so on, seeing no other questions, final word, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, members, for looking at that this bill. I'm very eager to implement this and very excited about the possibility that we could actually pass a bill that actually does address healthcare costs. And to your point, Representative Grunhagen, you know, bureaucracy, this is I'm trying to keep as an independent entity that does this evaluation and works with stakeholders on this advisory council for advice and to make sure they're working and bringing everybody to the table to address this problem of rising healthcare costs. It's a big problem to tackle. We need the best people at the table. And I'll just note that, you know, the MCHOP borders were created for reinsurance, and I didn't hear any complaints from you when that was created. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Sore subject this morning still. Okay, with that, House Bill 4330 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Okay, Representative Bierman, are you ready, or shall we go on to Representative Howard if he's here? I don't know if he is, but Representative Bierman, are you?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am ready for the brief review on that bill, please.
All right, so we'll take up your bill, and then we'll go to Representative Howard's bill. So we're going to move now to House File 3786, and Representative Bierman's motion is that House File 3786, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I just want to say, members, we had a full hearing on this bill, so we're going to ask Representative Bierman to just remind us of what the bill does. He can take some questions if there are any, and then we're going to vote on it. So, Representative Bierman. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I will just do the brief presentation that I spoke before the testifiers, and just to give members a background again, that in a 2015 letter, the American Cancer Society warned the CDC that their guidelines seeking to reduce inappropriate opioid prescribing had the potential to significantly limit cancer patient access to needed pain medications. Their quote was, "Our concerns are so serious, we cannot endorse the proposed guidelines in any way." The CDC guidelines were approved nevertheless and have been implemented, interpreted essentially as strict policy in more than 30 states, Minnesota included. In a 2021 letter, the American Medical Association stated the 2016 guidelines have been devastating for patients with pain and urge the removal of arbitrary thresholds, adding as well that the CDC's threshold recommendations continue to be used against patients to deny care. We know that this has harmed patients with cancer, sickle cell disease, and those in hospice. Restrictive policies also fail patients who are stable on long-term opioid therapy. Other states have already taken action to address the situation. Oklahoma, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and most recently Arizona acted to improve access to care for chronic and intractable pain patients. While there is still an opioid crisis in America, the threat is now primarily driven by illicit fentanyl on our streets. While prescribed opioids have dropped 60% since 2011, overdose deaths reached a record high last year. Those suffering from intractable pain and unable to access medication have been part of the collateral damage in this health challenge. It was Dr. Schultz with the Minnesota Society of Interventional Pain Physicians who testified before you and cited the New England Journal of Medicine's recent publication documenting that legitimate chronic pain patients who are forced off opioids have much higher incidence of ER visits, opioid hospitalizations, an increased incidence of mental health crises, and an increased risk of death from suicide. As Dr. Schultz, a 30-year veteran of treating pain patients, noted, opioids certainly have risks, but these risks can be effectively managed. The benefits of pain relief for improved function and better quality of life can be provided to our patients with intractable pain through sensible opioid prescribing, especially when no other viable options have proven effective. The opioid crisis is a very complex issue. Pain and addiction are distinct problems, but they intersect. Starting with this understanding, policies need to emerge to address each comprehensively. This bill is one of those policies. House File 3786 seeks to let medical doctors do their work, ensure pain patients receive the care they need, promote addiction treatment and care, and keep legislators and other bureaucratic entities from making medical decisions. Madam Chair, I do not have any testifiers today. I think members are familiar with the bill. I will mention thanks to DHS and look forward to continuing working with the department for implementation, and am open to take any questions, please.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Members, we did have a full hearing on this bill. So are there any additional questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Bierman will renew his motion that House File 3786, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 19 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, there being 19 ayes and 0 nays, the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Okay, we're going to go now to Representative Howard, House File 3265. So the chair will move that House File 3265, the second engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And there is also an author's amendment, the A4, and I think that's a technical amendment. Am I right, Representative Howard?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's a technical amendment to clarify some pieces that we adopted in the last committee.
Okay. So did you want us to adopt that first, and then we'll discuss the bill as amended?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So I will move the A4 author's amendment. All in favor of adoption of the A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Howard, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill dealing with an issue where I think we can have a lot of agreement that we should make sure that the water that our students are drinking at school is safe and free of lead. Since the Flint, Michigan crisis, we've seen a greater recognition of the danger of lead in our water. States have been taking steps to test, mitigate, and address what is a pervasive problem for many buildings that were built prior to the 80s. the reality is with the availability of newer health data and considering what other states are doing in this arena, Minnesota can and should do better. Children are most vulnerable to the damaging effects of lead because their bodies are still developing and absorb the harmful and absorb more of the harmful metal than adults. And we know from national data that this is a fairly pervasive problem in our schools. This bill seeks to take steps necessary to ensure that we're getting lead out of drinking water in every school in the state, which is a realistic and achievable goal, but only if we work together to take this problem more seriously. Currently, Minnesota schools are testing for lead and working in partnership with MDH and MDE on mitigation strategies. However, we don't really have a complete picture of the challenge because there is not any centralized reporting. In addition, schools that have been testing are mitigating at a level of 15 parts per billion or higher. And to be clear, this is not a health-based standard. There is no safe level for lead. But as I'll mention, we do have more data and better data available to better assess what that level should be. The other challenge is this can be costly for schools to conduct testing and to do remediation. Not as costly as some of the lead service line replacement issues that I think we've heard about. We're talking more about fixtures and plumber fittings, but those costs can certainly add up. And so this bill attempts to address those issues in a couple of ways. First, we require centralized reporting so that we as policymakers and the public has a better handle on this issue. A national survey of districts found that 37% tested for elevated lead levels. And how does that track here in Minnesota? The answer is we have no idea, which is why we need better reporting and more transparency. We also move the threshold for remediation from 15 parts per billion to 5 parts per billion. Again, there's no safe level for lead, but newer research has found harm from consumer water with levels above 5 parts per billion. And of note, that is the maximum amount of lead contamination the U.S. FDA allows for bottled water. It's a direction other states are going, and we should follow suit. We also include funding in this bill. If we're asking districts to mitigate, we believe state funding is appropriate. Some federal dollars are now available to districts to do remediation, but we think more is warranted, and this bill includes funding through MDH, a program that aligns with parameters that are included in the governor's supplemental budget. We've also added a funding mechanism that's more so in the jurisdiction of the Education Committee that provides an additional mechanism for districts to receive funding for mitigation. As I wrap up, I want to be clear that existing communication and partnership is happening with districts, with MDH, with MDE to test and mitigate. They're doing good work. But with additional resources and better data collection, we can build on that great work for the benefit of cleaner drinking water and healthier kids. I don't have a testifier today, but did want to just share some of the testimony from a previous committee from Dr. Shelby Graff, a pediatrician who works at Missanic Children's Hospital and HCMC Caring for Children. She told our committee in the previous stop that in young children, the effects of lead toxicity are devastating. And as soon as children show any symptoms, it's considered an emergency. And there are no known treatments for lead in the blood. Students with elevated lead levels struggle with development delays, higher dropout rates, reading disabilities, and other effects include kidney damage, seizure, and growth delays. Dr. Graff notes that the only way to prevent lead toxicity is to provide children with an environment in which they are protected from lead exposure, which is why this bill is so important. Thanks, Madam Chair, and I'd stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Howard. And this committee's been hearing quite a bit about lead. We know there's no safe level, and appreciate your bringing this bill to us. It's been a big topic for us this session. Are there any questions from members or any discussion? Representative Pryor.
Thanks. And no safe levels of lead. And as Representative Howard just said, too, once that toxicity has affected a child's development, we can't fix it. So the only thing to do is prevent it. So, you know, it's great this year that we're getting serious about this issue and understanding that what we have to do is prevent the poisoning from lead, because we can't go back and cure kids after it's happened.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any other questions or comments from members? All right, I'm not seeing any. Final word, Representative Howard?
I don't have anything additional, Madam Chair. I thank the committee for hearing the bill and their work on this issue generally this session.
All right, thank you very much. So with that, House File 3265, the second engrossment as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Appreciate it, Representative Howard.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we have Representative Wasilewicz is here, and she has three bills. And before we get going on them, I just want to say that these were heard in the Preventive Health Division. They are not here to rehear them completely because they had a complete hearing in that division. They are here. First of all, Representative Freiberg is going to move. We're going to do them one, two, three. We can't do them all at the same time, even though they're related. But I just do want to say that they're really here so that we can talk about the fiscal notes, if there is any discussion to the fiscal notes. So I'd like to really, other than just a brief overview of what we're talking about here, I'd like to keep our discussion to the fiscal notes. So the first one would be House File 2906. And Chair Freiberg, if you would, the motion would be to move to adopt the division report on House File 2906, the first division engrossment. So would you care to make that motion?
Sure. I will move to adopt the division report on House File 2906, the first division engrossment.
All right. Great. So I think we could take a voice vote on this, just adoption of the report. So all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the report is adopted. And then Chair Freiberg would move that the House File 2906, the first division engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So with that, and that would be your motion, Representative Freiberg, is that correct?
Sure. So
moved. Okay. Thank you. So with that, to your bill, Representative Wasilewicz, mainly to the fiscal portion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the three bills that are up, I know we're talking about one right now, but all have to do with PFAS, which are per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They're used in many consumer products, and they have been linked to a host of negative health impacts. From everything from increased cholesterol to decreased fertility, decreased birth weight, a whole range of things, negative health impacts. And so that's part of the reason why they're going through health committee, also because of the fiscal notes that the chair mentioned. And I will say that the fiscal notes for all three bills are almost identical. I think there's maybe a one digit difference in one of the fiscal notes because it's a similar process that Department of Health would go through in terms of what they would be doing on each of these bills that would ban a specific type of product. So the fiscal notes are, again, pretty similar, and I have reached out to agency staff to ask a question about if we passed multiple of these bills, how would that impact the cost in terms of whether there would be some fewer FTEs required or fewer funds required to implement that if they're doing more than one. I haven't received an answer yet, but did get acknowledgement that that is something that is being looked at, and so that's sort of what we're waiting for is just, you know, what if the cost of one of these is this much, how much would it be for three or four of them, the three of my bills and then Representative Katiza Witoon's bill as well. So waiting on an answer on that, but I think the answer that I'm assuming we'll hear is that there will be each fiscal note separately, the cost would be somewhere in between what it would cost for each separate fiscal note, just because they'd already have staff in place doing the outreach work and the testing and that sort of thing with the product.
Okay. Are there any questions? All right. Not seeing any. So very good. So with that, House File 2906, the first division report, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And then we have House File 2907. Chair Freiberg, I don't know if you have the notes in front of you, or would you? I don't want us both to have to read the whole thing. Go ahead.
I don't have the notes, but I'm going to guess that the motion is that I will move to adopt the division report for House File 2907, the first division engrossment.
The first engrossment. Very good. All right. So there's the motion, members. All in favor of adoption of the committee of the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The report is adopted. And then we need a motion to actually bring the 2907, the first engrossment, for it to be laid over for possible inclusion.
I'll move that House File 2907 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, great. So Representative Wasilewicz, anything additional? Maybe just tell us which one this bill is and yep. What's different.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So 2906 was banning the use of PFAS in cosmetics. 2907, which is before us right now, is banning the use of PFAS in cookware. And the fiscal note is pretty similar to what we saw with 2906, and it's essentially for MPCA has most of the funding because of the work that they have to do on enforcement, but there is some funding for the Department of Health for them to help with education and then evaluating products to see if they meet the ban definitions. And they have done things like this before, and they partner with MPCA and with the Department of Commerce on similar things, including the PFAS and food packaging ban that we passed last session. So this is not new territory for them. They sort of know what they need to do this work, and that's presented in the fiscal note.
Great. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none. So Representative Chair Freiberg would renew his motion that House File 2907, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill, and the bill is laid over. So thank you. And we will move to House File 2952. Same drill, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move that we adopt the division report for House File 2952, the first division engrossment.
Great. Okay, so that brings the division engrossment before our committee. All those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the division report is before the committee, and then the motion is...
I will move that House File 2952 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, great, thank you. So anything further on that one, Representative Wasilewicz, you might want to just tell the committee what that one does.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a similar bill to the other two, except this is a ban on using PFAS and ski wax. And this is, you know, Minnesota's a big state that has a lot of skiing, and so we want to ensure that folks are exposed to PFAS through that avenue as well, whether people are actually skiing or the ski wax, the PFAS is getting into the groundwater and folks are drinking it. So another effort to try and do that preventative piece on PFAS, and similar if not identical language in the fiscal note for what the Department of Health would use these funds for.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to that or questions? All right, seeing none. So House File 2952, the first division engrossment, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you very much, Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Next, we have House File 3571. This is Representative Katiza Watoon. And this is another bill that has been heard in the Preventive Health Division and had a full hearing there. And so, Chair Freiberg, did you want to move the division report on House File 3571, the first engrossment?
Sure. I will move the division report on House File 3571, first engrossment.
All right. All in favor of adoption of the report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The report is adopted. And then Chair Freiberg.
I will move motion. House File 3571 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Great. Thank you. We're getting this done. By the end, we'll have it really down. Thank you very much. So welcome, Representative Katiz Watun, and please go ahead and tell us briefly about your bill. Are we really more focused on the financial piece of it since it had a full hearing?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing a variety of PFAS ban bills today. As Representative Wasilewicz mentioned, we received some fiscal analysis that we are guessing there's going to be some overlap should we move forward with these. But this bill, my bill, is to ban PFAS and the use of juvenile products, which is everything from like car seats to booster seats to high chairs to play mats, anything really that babies are coming into contact with on a relatively frequent basis. As we know, our young children are exploring the world orally, so they're putting a lot of things in their mouth in addition to just the skin to product contact that they're going that is happening on a really regular basis. So just given the concerning information that we've received about the potential for PFAS to cause cancers and a variety of other illnesses and how long these substances stay within our bodies, we wanted to make sure that we take action and protect our littlest Minnesotans from this ongoing exposure from you know the earliest days of their life. So the fiscal analysis shows, I believe, similar to Representative Wasilewicz, a 0.25 FTE in the health department, as well as a full-time FTE in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to help with testing and enforcement. So I think that is in the materials for all the members, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you very much. It sounds like you have a testifier there in the background to talk about the children's products.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. He it does not apply to used products. So if anyone, we are fiscally responsible in this household. And so there, we've reused and received some products from friends. And so ongoing, that is a consideration of the bill should people buy secondhand or receive hand-me-downs from families. But this will apply to new products that are being manufactured or sold in the state of Minnesota. Right. And Representative Wasilewicz actually thought that this was a good bill for me to carry because she's seen my son put a number of things in his mouth over the last 2 years.
Oh, goodness. Well, they all do, don't they? So, okay. Members, any questions or discussion? Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill author, Representative Katiz Watun, do you know if there's anything happening at a national level on this issue?
Representative Katiz Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Damuth, there is some conversations happening in D.C. about PFAS in general and where they might go federally from this. But this is, you know, we were told over the last few years that they were going to be taking action on this. And so I don't think that we should wait for the feds. We know from long time experience that things are talked about, considered, and then don't end up happening. So I think that this is a good way for Minnesota to take the lead on something like this. There are a number of other states who have started to take action, but I think this is a really good way for us to protect our littlest Minnesotans.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, members. So with that, House File 3571, the first engrossment, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Appreciate your time, Representative Katiz Watun.
Madam Chair.
Okay. We are going to move on then to House File 3161, Representative Wolgamott. And so Representative Wolgamott's motion is that House File 3161 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And he has an author's amendment. Representative Wolgamott, I assume you want to move that right now.
That is my motion, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. So the A1 author's amendment is before us. And I believe that's more or less technical, changing sort of.
It is, Madam Chair. Yes.
Okay. So that is before us. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Wolgamott, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here to present House File 3161 as amended, which would deem that a Ford medical graduate who applies to the Minnesota Department of Health for a J-1 visa waiver recommendation is having satisfied the requirement to pass the United States medical licensing examination if the foreign medical graduate is licensed to practice medicine in the state of Minnesota. I want to give a little bit of background on what a J-1 visa does, Madam Chair. The J-1 visa program allows foreign physicians to participate in U.S. graduate medical education programs or training at U.S. medical schools. To be eligible, physicians must be proficient in English, have passed either Parts 1 and 2 of the National Board of Medical Examiners examination, the Foreign Medical Graduate Examination, Step 1 and 2, or the Visa Qualifying Examination prepared by the National Board of Medical Examiners. J-1 visa holders may reside and work in the U.S. for up to 5 years. After 5 years, J-1 visa holders must either return to their home country for 2 years or seek a J-1 waiver, which, if granted, waives the requirement to return to their home country. So that's what the J-1 visa does. Here is who approves it. The State Department approves or disapproves J-1 waiver applications. The Minnesota Department of Health, however, recommends approval of up to 30 applications to the State Department. Here's why I'm bringing this bill forward, Madam Chair. CentraCare, a healthcare provider in my district, employs a Canadian physician, Dr. Kyle Martin, who would like to seek a J-1 waiver recommendation from the Department of Health. Dr. Martin is not eligible to seek a recommendation from NDH because he has not passed the USMLEs, that United States Medical Licensing Examination. He has passed the Canadian equivalent, the Medical Council of Canada Evaluating Examination. So Dr. Martin holds an H-1B visa, which is reserved for occupations that require theoretical, practical application of a body of highly specialized knowledge, as well as hold a foreign degree that's the equivalent to U.S. bachelor's degree or higher degree required by the specialty occupation from an accredited college or university. So that's why I bring this bill forward. It would simply allow for a license to practice medicine in Minnesota to substitute for the passage of the USMLEs for purposes of applying for a J-1 visa recommendation. So if a physician has been granted a license to practice medicine in Minnesota, they would then be able to, we feel like that has a qualification and that there's no dilution of education or expertise. And again, lastly, Madam Chair, I want to make clear, the bill would not only make a J-1 visa holder who holds a license eligible to apply for the J-1 visa waiver recommendation. It just makes them eligible to apply. It does not compel MDH to grant the recommendation. So anyway, a little background on J-1 visas, a little background on the application process, and then just some insight on why I'm bringing this bill forward for person in my district. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I have some testifiers to provide further insight to this legislation and why we need it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I'm sure our members didn't think they were going to be doing immigration policy, but it's one of those overlap kind of things. So we have Kyle Martin. If my notes say video, is there a video from him? Is that what we're going to see here?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Jody Gerken. For the record, I'm with CentraCare, and I have a video of Dr. Martin, who sends his regrets that he can't be here today, but fortunately for us, he is taking care of patients.
So okay. I am going to share my 2 minutes?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, great.
And I apologize, the quality is not great, but the message is clear.
My name is Kyle Martin. Surgeon in central Minnesota. I'm actually from Canada originally, not that far from here in Winnipeg. And I did my undergraduate, my medical school, and my orthopedic residency in Winnipeg, Canada. Following my orthopedic surgery residency, I did go over to Oslo, Norway, and spent 1 year working over there. And I followed that up with a second year a fellowship down in Rochester at Mayo Clinic. When I did go to Mayo Clinic, I was on a J visa, And following my time at Mayo, I transitioned my J visa to an H-1B visa to work here in central Minnesota. So as a background, there are two ways to obtain an H-1B visa to work as a physician. The most common is to complete the three steps of the United States Medical Licensing Examination, or USMLE, while the second is to obtain an exemption to that USMLE requirement. As a Canadian, I did not take the USMLE examination during my training, and so I applied for and was granted the H-1B exemption based on the work I have done and continue to do. So the H-1B exemption granted by USCIS, United States Customs and Immigration Service, is for a physician who is recognized to be of international or national renown. So I'm currently working in central Minnesota on my H-1B, and I also hold a full Minnesota medical license, but I am currently not eligible for permanent residency because of my previous J visa status. This remains the case until I either leave the United States for 2 years or obtain a J visa waiver through the Conrad Waiver Program. The federally administered Conrad Waiver Program allows physicians to waive the 2-year home country return requirement if working in medically underserved areas and the state decides who can apply for the waiver. In Minnesota, it is currently a requirement to have the USMLE completed to be considered for the Conrad program, and this is not a federal requirement. So given my situation, our proposal is to allow a physician such as myself with a full license to practice medicine in Minnesota to be eligible for the waiver recommendation in place of the USMLE requirement.
And Madam Chair,
thank you.
We do have an immigration attorney, Deborah Schneider, on the call if there are questions. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Okay, are there questions for members? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who this question might be for, but I'm just wondering what the opportunity here is. I mean, we're looking at the one physician who we would like to keep, I would think, and not send doctors away for 2 years. You might lose them, and I'm just wondering what the opportunity is. How many physicians are in a similar predicament in Minnesota that we risk losing for our service?
So maybe Ms. Schneider could answer that. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and tell us your name and who you're representing, and then go ahead and answer the question.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Deborah Schneider, immigration attorney with Fredrickson and Byron, and I'm here on behalf of CentraCare and Dr. Martin. The expansion of the USMLE to allow for a Minnesota medical license in lieu of the USMLE could impact other Canadian physicians. It would most likely be limited to Canadian physicians because of how the Minnesota licensing statute is drafted. Specifically in the statute, it allows for taking the USMLE or the Canadian equivalent for a physician who's been through an accredited U.S. medical school or Canadian medical school. But being from where we are in Minnesota, we do attract quite a few Canadians. And so many are hesitant to come if it means they have to return back home for 2 years. And so this would expand opportunities to allow those to continue working here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Okay. Other questions? All right. Not seeing any. So with that, House File 3161 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. Thank you. Thank you, testifiers. And finally, we have, I can't believe it, finally, it's only 2:24. But Representative Morrison has House File 4076, and Representative Morrison's motion would be that House File 4076 be laid over possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. And there's an author's amendment. Representative Morrison, did you want to have that adopted first?
Yes, I would, please, Madam Chair.
All right, so Representative Morrison is moving the A1 author's amendment. All in favor of adoption of the author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Morrison, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 4076, as amended, transfers state-funded FASD prevention grants from DHS to MDH. Proof Alliance is our long-standing partner working to prevent FASDs, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and serving the community grappling with this condition. The prevention grants are $750,000 a year, and I think it's a better fit at MDH. MDH has a base budget for other FASD outreach and intervention activities, and so Proof Alliance and MDH will be able to maximize the many community partnerships involved with this work, making a stronger impact for healthy pregnancies. I do have two testifiers today, if time permits, who can speak to the specific work being done with these grants, Madam Chair.
All right, well, thank you. And time does permit since we've been moving right along. So thank you for that. Sarah Messalt, if I'm saying it right, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Sarah Messalt. I'm Executive Director of Proof Alliance. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4076, which supports remarkably effective FASD prevention grants for women with substance use disorders and their children. Originally piloted at Olmsted County and now is expanded to two other locations in the state. We know that with the right supports, women with substance use disorders can maintain sobriety and lead healthier lives with their children. As Representative Morrison indicated, currently the funding is at DHS and they contract the funding to Proof Alliance, who in turn we manage the funding, including the RFP process, the subgrantee administration, technical assistance, and reporting. Our respectful ask is to move this grant from DHS to MDH. The funding aligns with Proof Alliance's current base grant at MDH. These prevention grants use a public health and prevention approach that can be more effectively administered at MDH. Additionally, Proof Alliance has an effective working relationship with MDH over the years. We've partnered on many projects and we work together on that base grant as previously stated. We hope that over time we can build on our existing partnership with MDH, creating administrative efficiencies for both our base grant and prevention grant. And we also clearly acknowledge that administering grants requires some internal resources for MDH. And so by passing this bill this session, we will have time to carefully plan with MDH to make this work better for all partners, including MDH, grantees, and all the pregnant women, moms, and children that are impacted by this funding. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
All right, thank you. And we have Justin Breaker. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As I mentioned, my name is Justin Breaker. I'm a program supervisor with Family Service Rochester, located in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm going to share a story about an experience that one of our clients had that have benefited from the grant, such grants. And the names in the story are altered for confidentiality. Ellie had received case management support from Family Service Rochester. She had recently moved to the area and left a relationship that was unhealthy and filled with domestic violence. When she first connected with FSR, she was about 6 months pregnant. She also had two other children who were not in her care at this time due to past substance use. The program quickly got her engaged with programming and support groups in order to connect her with other moms in the area that were actively in recovery. The program helped her continue with her school and provided her transportation when needed to doctor's appointments and classes so that she can continue to work on her education and also maintain a healthy pregnancy. The program was also able to connect her with housing resources where she was able to move into an apartment that provided case management services as well as many financial resources. The FSR program case managers were able to also be there to help provide her with support as she went through the process of submitting court documents to regain custody of her other children. In October, this mom gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Although the baby was born 4 weeks early, he has continued to impress his pediatricians with phenomenal growth in height, weight, and overall development. The mother has also continued to impress her professionals that she works with. She is currently getting ready to complete her general education diploma with plans of transitioning into the local community college to work towards her license for alcohol and drug counseling. She has also been approved for a court hearing that she's looking forward to and hopes to regaining custody of her older children. There's been a lot of collaboration with other community agencies while working with this mother. The FSR program has collaborated with parent support and outreach workers, family support, and assistance of Olmsted County to navigate her housing and financial benefits, a representative from Skyline Incorporated for continued housing support, Olmsted County Public Health and Partnering Education, and mental health services with Zumbro Valley Health Center. The collaboration has ensured that this mother is receiving wraparound services to best support her and her children while she continues to navigate motherhood while in recovery. Thank you for your time and allowing me to share the story with you today.
All right, thank you, Mr. Breaker. And, you know, I've long been a supporter of this program. I think it's really does a lot of great things. But the actual bill before us today, though, I think is about more about really moving the program from one agency to the other. And I wonder if Representative Morrison, if I could ask you, or maybe Ms. Messelt, a little bit more. I was looking at the language of the bill, and could you, maybe Representative Morrison, could you just talk about the changes from the amendment that we adopted and kind of what we're exactly doing in the bill right now?
Madam Chair, you are correct. We are moving the grants to MDH from DHS. And the amendment, the original bill asked for increased funding of grants, and the amendment returns it to its baseline level of funding. And maybe Ms. Messelt could elaborate more if needed.
Okay, Ms. Messelt, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, no. Essentially, that's exactly what we aim to do.
Okay. Do other members have questions or comment about the bill? Okay. I guess I'm still just a little bit unclear about what the advantage is of making the move. We can maybe talk a little bit more offline as well, but, anyway, it's kind of unusual. Let me just ask it this way. Is there something different this year, or is this just been something that's been kind of coming for a few years, this change in where you want the program to live? Ms. Messelt?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes. It has been kind of growing over time, I think, especially as the program has taken deep roots in the communities that they serve. And I mentioned, we feel strongly that this approach fits really well with collaboration with, you know, our public health partners, home visiting. And so the alignment of the grant just feels like there's more opportunity for synergies and collaborations within the programs that are administered at MDH. Additionally, there has been, because we are, these are state funds, and we are a part of, at DHS, where we have been for approximately 8 years, and are in the treatment, substance use treatment block grant area, it has oftentimes felt like a bit of a round peg in a square hole, or whatever that saying is, in terms of not having a great fit in terms of where we land within DHS. And so it felt like that the time was right to begin to explore this and to really maximize efficiencies for the program dollars and what we're able to do in the community.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really would like to get the input from the Lansings and Olmsted County as to the pros and cons of this change also, because I remember we started out and then we lost the state funding and the county picked it up and covered it, and I just want to make sure that the transition didn't have any unforeseen consequences, and the chair might understand where I'm coming from. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Quam. Any further comment? Representative Morrison, and I'll let you have the final word. I don't see any other questions, and maybe you can consider Representative Quam's comment as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present the bill. I think that we have to listen to the people who are administering the programs, who are on the ground closest to the people who benefit from them, and they're telling us that there are better synergies at MDH than DHS for these grant programs. So I hope that you will consider this in the omnibus, and we appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. So with that, House Bill 4076, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So that does conclude our agenda for the day. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we conclude today, just wondering what the timeline looks like for next week when we might see the omnibus bill and what your targets might look like. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So we are working very, very hard, as we have been, to get the bill together to bring forward. It's obviously going to happen as soon as we possibly can next week. You know, I just want everyone to understand, and I do want to say this publicly as well, that the agencies of state government and indeed the legislature itself, we all have the same impacts from COVID and the Great Resignation and all of the forces that are acting upon all the other organizations in our state and in our country and probably the world. So we are short-staffed. People are working very, very hard. And this has turned out to be an extraordinarily complex task. In a year when we normally are not, this is not a funding year, supposedly. It's not a budget year, but it's turned out to be both a budget year and a policy year and all of these things layered. So the short answer, Representative Schumacher, is just as soon as we possibly can, we are going to get the bill out into the committee. Whether we're going to actually be able to meet the deadline or have to take the bill to rules, I cannot say at this time. People are working just as hard as they can, and we know that a lot of time our staff do the impossible, but we can't expect the impossible because there are a lot of human beings behind all of this work that's going on. In terms of targets, I mean, this was a discussion on the floor yesterday. I can't really add anything to that in terms of numbers. What I will tell you, though, is that personally, I've often wondered why we have this weird procedure in the legislature where we put forward these numbers, like a menu of numbers, and we say so much for this area and so much for that area. Frankly, I don't think human beings think that way. I think that it's always been mysterious to me and kind of hard to understand. I mean, it does tell you, you know, there's more in this area than that area. On the other hand, sometimes items cost more in this area than that area. So I think it is very hard to really draw any meaning from just a list of targets. And it does make more sense to me if we were able to kind of say, what are the needs of Minnesotans in this area? What are the needs in that area? And then build our targets that way rather than kind of from the top down. So that's just my personal view. I don't know when the actual targets are going to be revealed or what that will look like, but I feel pretty comfortable with putting together a bill, it's above my pay grade to say when exactly those targets will be made public. So, Representative Schumacher, anything further on that?
No, Madam Chair, just good luck.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. And we're going to have a lot of work ahead of us. And I so appreciate everybody's hard work. This committee has just been extraordinary in the amount of work you all are willing to do. And I think it's been a very productive committee. Good questions from all of you. A lot of good work is being done here. And we are not done yet. And I hope we're going to have really results that we can be really proud of for the people of Minnesota, because we do know that this committee knows as well as any that there are a lot of needs out there, and we're going to do our very, very best to meet those that we can. So With that, if there's no further discussion, I can let you all go about your Friday. Enjoy a little bit of spring. So thank you so much. We stand adjourned.